You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is September 23rd, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How you doing, guys?
Good.
Hanging in there.
You know, well, what do you expect, Steve? You know, that's the real question.
Yeah.
Surviving.
Well, before we get to the COVID news, guess what I saw out my back window this week?
Another bear.
Okay, well, it wasn't a bear. It was
a second bear.
A girl with
it
a
was
forage.
A lame raccoon.
Well, I saw three raccoons this morning. That's actually not unusual.
I could beat that.
A fox. It was a fox in my backyard. Very pretty.
Ooh,
I could beat that.
I've never seen a fox. We don't have them.
They're beautiful.
I think it was chasing the chipmunks. Got a picture. Absolutely got a picture.
Sweet.
It was like the fox turned and looked at me, so I got a beautiful like profile, but with his head turned towards me, so you could 100% identify it as a fox. So what's really interesting is that the tremendous uptick in wildlife in my backyard recently. It's like Mutual of Omaha's Natural Kingdom back there.
You're a second level druid now, so that happens.
Just come.
I have 20 years of anecdotal data, you know, to go on. Like every morning, look out my bathroom window when I get up. It's pretty, you know, sometime around dawn. It's always birds, you know, squirrels, chipmunks, that kind of thing. Occasionally you'll see a deer. That's about it, you know. But this summer, man, and this fall, obviously the bear was the big thing. But like every day there's a deer or there's
I just saw something an hour ago. Best thing I've ever seen.
Bobcat?
Like in my year, I saw two bobcats strolling across our backyard. Holy crap. I ran to my binoculars. Got him. I got
get a picture.
They disappeared before I can get a picture. So you have to take my word for it. They were. Oh my god! These were like 30-pound cats, 30-pound house cats. They were spotted on the back of the legs and the belly. A very short tail, surprisingly short tail, and they were just these huge. Like they looked like little tigers. Little tigers. They were like sitting there, kind of looking at me. And then I saw one crouch, looking at something in the woods, because it's right at the edge of the woods.
Oh, jeez.
Crouching down and then pounced on something. Didn't see what it was, but it was a classic thing you see your cat do all the time. Two of them, they were gorgeous. I was just like, I want to just play with them, you know, before, you know, but of course they'd scratch me. But it just made my entire week. They were gorgeous.
Yeah, so no, there definitely is an increase in that kind of, you know, predatory wildlife in southern Connecticut. Typically, what we're seeing is more typical of like northwest Connecticut, which is mostly wilderness. But for some reason, they're spreading south. And, you know, the simple explanation
social
is that
distancing, of course.
They're following the food. So there's an uptick in small critters and the bobcats, coyotes, foxes, and bears are following them.
Oh, my.
But I'm not really sure why there's such an uptick in, you know, rodents and those kind of animals, which I've also noticed. Like, my wife and I walk around our neighborhood, and we'll see 20 rabbits, you know, just walking around the neighborhood. They're just in everyone's yard.
20.
What's going on?
It's like
though,
the
Steve,
Teletubbies out there.
What do you think is happening?
Cool.
Not sure.
La, la.
Honestly, not sure.
Tinky winky.
Ow.
Yes, my daughter grew up watching that.
They did eradicate a feral cat population one town north of me in Cheshire. I know the Cheshire cat, right?
Oh, that would help a lot.
And so maybe that's it. Maybe the cats are gone, so there's more little life, and now the bobcats and coyotes and foxes are following them.
Yeah, one of the stories that I had pitched for today, which I'm not doing because we liked a different story better, is really about the havoc that house cats wreak on local wildlife. They kill so many birds. They kill so many small rodents. And yeah, there's a big downstream ecological effect from that.
What, do they kill more than windmills?
Oh my God, orders of magnitude, billions.
Yes. But and the thing is too, you know, we
exactly
talk about
hunt.
Feral cats, which is dangerous, right? But also just people's house cats, their pet cats, really should not be outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I still haven't seen a bobcat in my backyard, Bob, so you got me on that.
Oh,
I've seen coyotes on the side of the road, but I haven't seen one in my yard.
They're magnificent. It's just weird because you hear about foxes all the time and deer, of course, but to think that there's these huge cats, I mean, 30 pounds at least,
yeah,
that's surviving in the wild. out there and you just never see them. There's got to be a
they must be eating
population,
squirrels or something,
right? What
right?
are they eating? Yeah, I don't right. know, but they're just so magnificent.
Yeah. All right. So the COVID numbers, the big news this week is yeah. that the United States has surpassed 200,000. As we're recording this, the official number is at least 201,000 Americans have died of COVID-19. You know, that hoax illness that doesn't really exist.
Steve, what do you have to say? You know, this is something I see quite a bit in the arguments that are given against yeah. COVID. Like they're saying that hospitals are, you know, mislabeling, right?
And every, yeah, every to, death to, is a COVID death, right, Jay?
I've tried to explain
they make
to
money.
People. Yeah.
It's not true. It's simply not true.
I know. I say that. I've said that. And I try to also explain that, you know, you don't necessarily, quote unquote, die from COVID. You die from things that COVID does to you. You know, you could die from pneumonia because of COVID, as an example.
Yeah, this is just ignorance, right? This is just straight up ignorance. So when you list the cause of death, you always go with like the most proximal cause of death, right? And then you list conditions that contributed to that cause of death. So like your proximal cause of death may be a heart attack, right? You had a cardiac arrest, your heart stopped, and you died. But what caused that? That could have been caused by pneumonia. What caused that? Well, that was caused by COVID-19. So did COVID-19 cause that death? Yes, absolutely.
That's not unique. This is how all deaths are recorded.
Oh yeah, this is I know, this is how all deaths are recorded. Yeah. This is standard operating procedure.
The misinformation has been weaponized.
Yeah. It's just stupid. People don't know what they're talking about, looking for things, you know, it's like it's anomaly hunting, as we say. You're looking for things you don't personally understand mm-hmm. or that just is unusual. And then you don't seek expert understanding. You just weave it into something sinister, right? That's because it serves your political or ideological purposes. That's what conspiracy mongers do. But this one is like so simple. I mean, this is like such standard practice in medicine and in hospitals. And the data is absolutely clear. If anything, we are grossly underestimating COVID deaths. So the excess deaths are increased more than the official COVID deaths. Also, just reading an article today about, you know, it's not just about the deaths. There is untold mortality and morbidity from COVID. The estimates are now that for every official COVID-19 death, that represents 10 lost person years of life, which is significant. And, you know, we're starting to see now the late complications. I'm starting to personally see patients
like what?
Who had COVID in the spring or in the early summer.
Like, and what? Now what are you, they, yeah, what
is
you saying?
A neurological issue?
Yeah, now they're having neurological complications. Chronic fatigue is very, very common. Mm. These people just don't bounce back. Like they are, you know, if you're seriously ill, neuropathy. I mean, again, still, we don't know exactly what was caused directly by the COVID. And there's a lot of chronic illness complications that you can get. If like you're in the ICU or you're just in the hospital for 6 weeks, things happen. But nevertheless,
even people who weren't admitted are complaining of severe complications. Like
really?
Continued chest pain, continued difficulty with breathing, you know.
Muscle weakness.
Yeah, just kind of extended illness, even though they're no longer
tested positive. A lot of like lightheadedness. I'm just dizzy. I just can't. You know, I mean, they just don't feel right. They're just off. But again, it's hard to disentangle just generic complications of being in the hospital for weeks versus direct effect of the infection with the COVID-19. Plus, you know, you get a lot of medications, a lot going on. But it doesn't really matter. It's like these people now have chronic debilitating symptoms or significant symptoms that they wouldn't have had they not contracted COVID-19. That's the important thing. So it's adding a lot of, you know, this is taking a huge toll on society. It's not just the 201,000 people who have died. It's all the people who were seriously ill and have survived. In the U.S., again, we're at least up to 6.8 million. Worldwide, the numbers are 32 million cases, 980,000 deaths, so we're approaching a million deaths worldwide.
Wow.
And if you look at the trends, you know, the for daily new cases worldwide, you know, it's leveling off, but at a really high level, at 300,000 or thereabouts per day. If you look at the U.S. numbers, we were starting to level off, but in the last few weeks, we're ticking back up. The direction of the
seven-day
rolling average has turned up. We are increasing. That curve is now going up. So they're saying that
positive.
This is just
cases.
Cases. Okay. So deaths, the thing is, deaths are pretty plateaued. But deaths are, it depends on how they're counted. There's like these weird spikes in deaths. And, you know, the New York New York was overwhelmed early. It wasn't just the number of cases that they had. This is the hospitals were most overwhelmed, like in the early spring.
Right, like they didn't have the beds, they didn't have the ventilators.
So there was just a huge death toll there.
And they were trying to figure out how to even treat this thing.
But where our deaths are, if you look at them, it's at a higher level than it was, say, in June, right? So it's still
not okay.
It's still pretty high. And again, it kind of took a recent uptick along following the cases, like, you know, these delays a couple of weeks behind the cases. So it's still significant, you know, 1,000 a day, something like that. 40,000 cases, 1,000 deaths a day were right around there. But yeah, there wasn't a spike from restarting school, but it's possible that this upturn is due to that. But there's other things going on too, like the campaign, for example. It's hard to say how much of a role that's playing, or just people getting tired of wearing masks and social distancing, you know.
And the virus finally getting to rural areas, just like making its way through the country.
Still going around. So I guess we're still technically in the middle of the first wave, even though it's kind of a complicated first wave. But, you know, it's still happening. This is not over. This is not over.
And again, what was the statistic that we mentioned? I think it was last week that we have 4% of the world's population and 25%. Is that right of the cases?
Yeah.
Something like that.
So,
right around there.
That's horrible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, six out of 30, 6 million versus 32
and we're considered
million,
by many to be one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Or
we certainly have the resources. We have as many resources as any other country in the world.
That's so frustrating.
There's no reason for this other than just straight up mismanagement. No question.
Yeah, policy failures.
This is just a pure policy failure. Absolutely. Very sad. And so, but, you know, again, we still don't know. Again, we're in the middle of this. You know, we have no idea what, looking back, what it's going to look like. Is there going to be a real second wave that hits the world or different parts of the world? You know, we will see. I think it's still a little too early to tell from schools. And this recent uptick is very concerning. So we still have to keep our eyes on this one. The vaccines are chugging along. You know, there's about 11 right now in phase 3 trials. The FDA just put out a statement, you know, essentially saying these are the criteria we're going to hold any COVID-19 vaccine to, which means it's not going to get approved probably by the end of the year. And just given the criteria they have, which is correct, they want to make sure that, you know, it works and it's safe.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting that the FDA kind of like doubled down and is doing the right thing, yet there's so much kerfufflage at the CDC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People are really starting to lose faith. And I mean, I want to trust my CDC. I want to think that it has not become a politicized problem, but...
Well, but it has, but we know that
clearly has.
Discouraging. Now, what can we trust and what can't we trust? And this is not good for public confidence at
all. We know that the White House has been essentially dictating CDC reports, mm-hmm. changing the wording of reports, suppressing reports, in line with Trump's political interests, pure and simple.
And choosing what gets posted and what doesn't, apparently.
Yeah,
that's the newest twist.
So that's
completely indefensible.
Straight up political interference. And so now everything the CDC does has a little bit of a sinister pall over it. So if, like, for example, on Friday, they put up a new website where they changed their statements about whether or not COVID-19 is airborne, right? And then they took it down. And they said,
it was a mistake.
It was a mistake. It was a draft and it wasn't ready to put up, and it would put up a mistake. Like, okay, maybe, but now we can't trust you because obviously you're politically compromised and you're not an independent science-based organization anymore. You are a political tool. Mm-hmm. And so now everything gets looked at through that filter.
So where are the, you know, I would expect in this situation there to be dozens, tens, you know, of whistleblowers. Like, where are they?
They're coming. I think they're coming. Yeah.
No, they're coming. They're totally coming.
What do you mean they're coming, though? I mean, like, you know,
they're starting to come out.
It's a process. Whistleblowing is a process if you're trying to do it the right way.
And Jay, this is how we know about this, right? Because people are blowing the whistle. They're saying the White House was dictating our reports. You know, this is what went into our reports. It was affecting the wording. This is we know that through whistleblowers.
Yeah. But remember, you don't just like turn around and go, let me tell the media something. I mean, a lot of people are really afraid for their futures and for their safety. And you add to that that people need to make sure that they're secure before they can do that. And there's a vetting process to whistleblowing. You got to make sure what they're saying is true.
Right. So, and by the way, I wrote about this on Science-Based Medicine today, just updating the data on, is COVID-19 airborne? So what we mean by airborne is that it spreads in tiny viral particles in tiny water droplets, not that it's spread by the large droplets. Mm. So it's aerosolized, you know, would be
right.
The word.
That's the word.
But in reality, it's a continuum. It's not like there's big particles and teeny particles. There's a continuum. But it is true that the primary way COVID is spread is through the larger droplets. You know, you're directly spitting droplets on people within 6 feet of you. That's why social distancing and mask wearing are probably the most effective measures. But there is some spread through direct physical contact or through fomites, right? Touching stuff. Mm-hmm. That's why hand washing, you know, not shaking hands and, you know, cleaning surfaces is also important.
Yeah, avoiding touching your face. Yeah.
And there's plenty of evidence now that it is spread through aerosolized, you know, airborne spread. Again, not the main mode of transmission, but in a non-insignificant, you know, mode. And so what does that mean? That means that indoor events are more dangerous than outdoor events. Good ventilation is helpful. And that if you are in the same physical place with people who have COVID, you need not just cloth masks, you need the N95 masks or better, right? You need something that will keep you from breathing in the particles. So the cloth masks keep you from spitting on other people, but the N95s or the filtration masks will keep you from breathing. It'll reduce the number of viral particles you're breathing in.
Which is why really masking and social distancing at the same time, like needing to have both of those factors, significantly reduces your risk. Because if you're far enough away from somebody who's breathing, and let's say you're outdoors, where those particles can dissipate much quicker. You're not in an enclosed space with low ventilation and you're wearing a mask. You're, you know, mostly safe if you're following those distances really well. I mean, given that you're not surrounded by, surrounded by positive people. But if you're in an enclosed space for extended periods of time and there are people who are positive there, your risk goes up significantly.
Yeah. That's why you got to do everything. You have to do everything. Mm-hmm. Good hand washing, wearing a mask, social distancing, and then not gathering in the indoor space. No mass gatherings, especially in indoor spaces. And just like, remember that story we talked about a couple of months ago where a church was having an event, and I think it was a Trump rally, and they said, well, we have good ventilation system. It's like, okay, that protects the 3% who get it or whatever from airborne spread.
Right.
Does absolutely nothing for the large particle spread. And so it doesn't obviate the need for mask wearing and social distancing. And also, no filtration system is good enough that if you have, you know, 1,000 people crammed into an auditorium, it's going to do anything about it.
No, that's why when you do science experiments, you do them in a vent hood, right? They're underneath a big glass sash, and then the ventilation is so intense that it just sucks everything straight up, but only your hands are in there. Your face is outside of the hood.
Okay, let's move on. Jay, you're going to start us off. You're going to start us off with the science news items. Actually, you and I are both going to talk about some material technology science stuff that are kind of related. But you're going to start off by talking about better batteries. How are we getting there?
Yeah, again, you know, there isn't a this huge innovation that's going to change the world. It's just the fact is that we have so many companies dumping millions and millions of dollars into research that we continue to roll out new and improved and better technology in lots of different ways. You know, do you remember we've said this so many times, like we've read dozens of news items where we're like, oh man, there's, you know, if this battery can be mass produced, it would be amazing. And it never is mass produced. But in the background, all of that, you know, smaller producing research builds up over time. And, you know, we've had an incredible decade of not dramatic, but steady and wonderful increases in battery technology that do lots of different things. So if we go back to 2010, a lithium ion battery pack with a 1 kilowatt hour capacity cost over $1,000. That single battery pack. And, you know, as an example, that would be able to, you know, an electric car would be able to drive 3 or 4 miles on that capacity of that one battery pack. In 2019, that same capacity lithium ion battery pack cost only $156. So industry forecasters are saying that, you know, the same capacity battery will fall under $100 by 2023 to 2025. Now, so we went from $1,000 to in the next few years, it could be under $100. You know, it's an order of magnitude less, and that is unbelievable. That's a fantastic reduction in just the last decade. So one of the main reasons electric cars are as expensive as they are is because of this, because battery packs are incredibly expensive. You know, electric cars today are still more expensive than similar gas-powered cars. We're seeing, you know, it's coming down, but you still have to pay that extra five, you know, seven, could be even like 10 or over grand, depending on how high end of a car you're getting, if you want to buy the electric version. But once the price, you know, gets to be around $100 or less for that simple battery pack, or if, you know, look at it more like
per kilowatt hour.
Yeah, for a single kilowatt hour, you know, we can expect these electric cars to start becoming less expensive, and there'll be a cost savings to actually buy an electric car. You know, this is going to happen within 3 to 5 years. So
well,
we are
good,
on the
because,
threshold.
Gavin Newsom just, you know, set a standard that in California, no gas cars should be sold after 2035.
Yeah, that's
not
a single gas car. That's great. And I, mm-hmm. I
sounds
you know,
doable, right?
I think so. By 2035, yeah, 15 years, I think so.
Yeah, the infrastructure has to be built. I mean,
California can build their own infrastructure.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the idea too is that if we can show that you can do it here, other states can follow suit. That's kind of long been the vehicle, like motor vehicle standard.
California's what, 1/6 of the country?
Exactly.
It's 55 million people.
And we're like a massive economy too.
It's not just car battery technology. I mean, we're talking about, you know, there's more and more products are using batteries, right? You know, batteries are in everything, it seems like, these days. So, you know, as the battery technology improves, the demand for batteries goes up. And as, you know, new technology is developed and rolled out, it inspires more companies to use even more batteries and more products. And this is a cycle, right? It feeds off of itself. So the more we buy, the more they'll invest money and the more innovation will happen and all the wonderful things that come with innovation. So one barrier we have also is, you know, we're using current battery technology to help with grid storage, right? We've talked about this. You know, most countries create electricity on demand when they need it, you know, by burning coal, you know, nuclear reactors, kinetic energy from flowing water and wind. And what's the problem? Storage. You know, we can't store huge amounts of electricity. We just don't have the ability to do it. So that's why we need these on the, you know, in the moment, like coal burning as an example. They could fire that plant up in you know, minutes. Just press a few buttons and have, you know, a few levers get pushed. And next thing you know, we're pumping out tons of electricity. We're also pumping out tons of CO2. And it comes at an incredibly high cost just to maintain these in the moment electricity.
On demand, yeah.
Yeah, the on-demand market. So it's not cost effective to use batteries today to store this energy, especially like if we wanted the batteries to last over a 24-hour period. We're not even close to that. But what we do use batteries for is to do like something called evening things out. You know, if we're in a situation where we just need help from battery storage for 15 minutes, which is
peak
a very
shaving.
Yeah. But that's a long time when in the rooms where people have all the buttons and knobs that are controlling the flow of energy and the creation of energy and the distribution, blah, blah, blah. If they had 15 minutes to switch over to something else from battery technology, it could help them not do ridiculously expensive things like turning on a coal-fired plant or buying electricity, on the market, getting completely ripped off by other companies, you know, because they absolutely have to get their hands on that electricity. This is happening. And I'll give you a good example in a minute here. So, of course, as the battery prices drop more and more, batteries are going to be used or starting to be used in grid storage until we eventually renewable energy will be able to be the primary source of electricity. We can finally get rid of things that are bad for the environment. And just a point of clarity, I am not saying that nuclear reactors are bad for the environment. In fact, they're not. And we should be building more because we have, you know, we have the fourth generation reactor technology now, which can burn a lot of the crap that was left over from the previous generations. Steve, don't get me started. So check this out. Batteries are now six times less expensive than they were 10 years ago. And we can expect a similar reduction over the next decade, which is great. They say it might slow down a little bit, but they're still chugging forward at a steady pace right now. Now, a huge player, of course, in all of this, I have to say, it has been Tesla. Look, we know there's a lot of Tesla haters out there and Musk haters out there. Putting him and, you know, the company aside, let's just talk about what they've achieved. And, you know, I'm not no fanboying. Let's just talk about the reality here. Tesla is both an electric car company and a battery technology company. They've heavily invested in battery technology. And because they knew from the beginning that the demand will always be there, when they first came up with the concept of grid storage and building the potential for grid storage, you know, they had the vision, they saw it, and they executed it, and now it's happening, which is an incredible thing. And they had incredible vision, you know, to be able to pull that off. They needed money to last for so many years before the sales started to happen and the technology came into its own. So when Tesla started in 2003, where were we? We had portable batteries and cell phones and laptop computers. This was a hugely growing market. And then in 2017, Tesla finally finished and the installation of that huge array of batteries at the Horsetail Wind Farm in South Australia. I know you guys remember this. This was a big deal. They swooped in and helped a very serious energy crisis that they were having in that part of Australia. And it was able to achieve 129 megawatt hour storage capacity, which equals about 10 million smartphones, right? I know that sounds like a lot. But is 129 megawatts a lot? It isn't as much as you think, but it's incredibly useful as it is. They were having a energy problem, and they were forced to buy electricity either from the market, which was charging them like 50 times their normal price, 50 times markup just because they were in the lurch. 50. And then, of course, they would also fall back on firing up gas-fired generators that they were using, super expensive to operate. And you want to know why? Like, one of the reasons is because they might only turn these things on a few times a year in a massive crisis. Mm-hmm. They might have to be like, push the red button. Frank, get over there. You know, the guy turns the damn thing on and it costs millions of dollars. But man, when those energy spikes, the demand would spike, you know, they were lucky to have it. But when they installed the battery array that they put in, a Tesla put in, it was a total game changer. It would only last about an hour. How about that? That battery system they put in only worked for about an hour, but that's exactly the amount of time that they needed to mitigate the crisis that they would find themselves in from time to time. So let me summarize this by saying that we have a lot of good news because we have an incredible amount of companies that are working on the technology. The engineers are innovating like all aspects of battery technology. Now, I'll give you an example. Like when the raw materials that they purchased to buy batteries, they're using more nickel now and less manganese and cobalt. And this is a big deal because it is a huge factor in the overall cost of batteries. And GM, as an example, has reduced their cobalt use in their batteries by 70% without degrading the quality. They're actually making improvements on the battery, you know, its capacity and everything, even though they're moving to a different raw material like nickel, which actually isn't, you know, dangerous or is expensive and hard to get your hands on. So we're going to still see good battery growth over the next decade. And we're going to actually see electric cars in the next 3 to 5 years really go, you know, increase in demand will go up because the prices are going to come down. And then eventually, at some point, we'll have a driverless car actually on the road, which, you know, I thought was going to happen years ago. So I want a electric driverless car. That's what I'm waiting for. That's my holy grail when it comes to battery technology.
I think having fully electric cars being cost competitive with gasoline cars without subsidies is like really the next milestone.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Tesla just announced, he said in 3 years, he'll be able to come out with a $25,000 Tesla.
Oh my
gosh,
that's a game changer.
Yeah, that's he said that's always been the goal, and he thinks he can get there in 3 years. So we'll see.
But Steve, isn't it interesting to know, though, that that is largely due to battery technology and not all the other technology?
Yeah, totally. So I'm going to talk about a couple of related technology items. And like with Jay's item, when you're talking about like batteries or solar technology or a lot of similar things, there's rarely any huge news, because it's built on this continuous trickle of incremental advances, and only some of which are actually going to be commercializable.
Right.
And so really, the news items that I'm going to be talking about are pretty minor, but they really are just a way of talking about the overall technology and to give you an example of some of the incremental steps that are happening along the way. So let's talk first about solar cells. Or solar panels. I think we're already there, actually, with solar in that, you know, I could produce 100% of the electricity my house uses with the area of my roof. So that's one milestone. I'm saving 20% on my electricity bill, so it's cost effective. So and I'm in Connecticut. It's not like I'm in Arizona or something. So I think we're mostly there in terms of solar panels being cost effective. But, you know, more is better. So, you know, I'm perfectly happy with incremental advances. And it would be nice to get the price, the initial investment down, to make them accessible to more and more people. You know, really every house should have solar panels on it, right? Depending on your solar coverage. But of course, the more efficient they get, the basically you're expanding the group of people, the group of homes, the group of applications where it is cost effective, right? You know, it's not like there's one line for cost effectiveness. It's all about the application. And so the cheaper they get and the more powerful they get, just the cost effectiveness and the practicality expands further and further, right? So that's what we're doing. So we're getting pretty much to the limit of silicon solar cells in terms of the theoretical limit of efficiency of how much of the light can they turn into electricity. Although we're very clever at figuring out ways to get past what we think are the limits. So with like the one thing that they're doing with the silicon solar panels is using multiple layers. Mm. And with the different layers being optimized for different frequencies of light. So in combination, they really harvest all of the light. But scientists are trying to make a move over to other materials that have a higher theoretical limit on the efficiency, right? And so the one that's getting a lot of attention, and I know we've mentioned it before on the show, is perovskite.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but the problem with perovskite is they're not stable. And so they break down. They can have a really high efficiency. They work really well, but they don't last very long out in the real world, out in the sun and the air and the moisture, you know. So the scientists are trying to figure out how do we stabilize the perovskite without sacrificing the efficiency advantage. And so here, I read items about this all the time. Here's another one, which is just to show you what the kind of things they're working on. So this is a team at the City University of Hong Kong, and they're using what are called MOFs, metal organic frameworks. Although I think they should figure out a way to make it MOFO instead of just.
Right, that's exactly what I thought. Oh my God.
And so this has been used for a while as a scaffold. You build the perovskite onto the scaffold. The problem with the MOFs, the metal organic framework, is that it's insulating. It's not conducting, so it reduces the efficiency because it gets in the way of harvesting the electricity. So this is the breakthrough, right? They figured out a way of making a 3D MOF using material that is a charge transporting material. So it actually will not reduce the conduction, of the electricity. It can be used as a charge carrier material as well. But in addition, here's another problem with the perovskite is that they use lead. And the problem with that is that over time, they leach lead into the environment. And of course, you also have to worry about the end of their life, which is not very long at this point, and then that lead getting into wherever they end up if you don't fully recycle them, which is hard to do cost-effective-wise. So this material also has the benefit of stabilizing the lead so that it does not leach out. And they claim that in their laboratory testing, it captured 80%, over 80% of the leaked lead ions from the degraded perovskite, and also formed a water insoluble complex with it that would not, leach into the soil or contaminate the soil. So is that good enough? I don't know, but it's, 80% is better than nothing. So they found that over 1,000 hours of testing, the panels retained 92% of their initial efficiency, which is within the range of commercializable solar panels. So I don't know if this is going to be the one that gets perovskites to the market or some version of this, or if other labs solving these problems in completely different ways are going to be the ones that get to over the finish line of a commercial product. But it feels like, following this news now for years, it feels like we're getting close to perovskites being producing a commercializable solar cell, and which could, significantly drop the cost of what it would cost to put solar panels on a typical house, for example, right? Because the more efficient they are, the fewer you need, therefore the less expensive they are. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a completely different line of research on organic solar cells, but which I'm not going to talk about today. We've talked about elsewhere, and maybe that will end up taking over. Organic cells, their problem is that they're very inefficient. They're down in the 10-12% efficiency, whereas silicon is getting up to about 20, 21. Perovskites could theoretically get up to 30. But organic cells can be a lot cheaper and easier to install, and they're very durable because they're flexible. So if we could just get their efficiency up, then they would be, that would push them over the commercializable threshold. So, but I'm perfectly happy with these just incremental advances in solar panels now, because I think we're already there. But the other one is perhaps a little bit more interesting, and this is more fundamental. This is, again, that sort of material science news, where when you improve the material science itself, the material, it creates a whole new opportunities. So this is using copper, right?
That's right, copper.
Yeah, copper.
That's right, copper.
That's right. Yeah.
Making better copper wire, right? How fundamental is copper material to electronics?
Right. Incredibly important. But Steve, when you say better, I mean, are they doing anything to the copper itself, or is it how
yes.
they wrap it?
No. So what they're doing to the copper is they are doing a composite with ultra conductive carbon nanotubes.
Hello.
There they are again.
Yep.
There
this you is go, not Bob. A, not a new idea, mm-hmm. but what they were able to do is use a process that allowed for two things. One, for the carbon nanotubes to be in longer segments, which is critical if you're trying to increase conductivity, right? You need the long segments to make sure that one conducts to the next, et cetera. And then also to align them better. They all need to be heading in the same direction, because again, you want them to be conducting in the direction of the copper wire, for example. And they need to have few defects and be stable, right? So they were able to demonstrate that they could do this in cost-effective, scalable manufacturing processes that have already been shown to work, and that the resulting copper was able to reach a 14% greater capacity with up to 20% improved mechanical properties. So think about that. So that 14% greater current capacity doesn't sound like, that does sound pretty incremental, right? But think about it. If everything that uses copper as a part of the electrical equipment could be 14% smaller.
Yeah.
Think about how significant that could be. So we talked about, for example, like how feasible is an electric plane, right? And it turns out like one of the big limiting factors is, well, to generate that much power, you need just really huge and heavy electrical equipment, you know? It's not necessarily the batteries that's the limiting factor. It's the things that turn the batteries into mechanical energy. But if everything could be made 14% smaller or thereabouts, even if the ultimate effect is, say, 10% smaller, then that's a huge step towards some application like that being feasible. In something so fundamental, like just copper conducting material, making it stronger and increasing its capacity by 14%. Doesn't sound sexy, right? But this could have reverberating effects throughout the solar battery energy production. You know, again, electric car world is, you know, our electric cars, are we going to be able to shave a few percent of weight off of electric cars and including making them more efficient, therefore more mileage and all the things that go along with that. So this is something to keep our eye on. And it's also cool that it's an application of carbon nanotubes, right? It's something that we've been talking about for a long time. And here you go. You know, so this is just having a lot of aligned carbon nanotubes in a multi-layer composite structure with copper.
Steve, you know what I tried to do?
Simple but great application. Yeah.
I tried to buy a bag of carbon nanotubes so Bob could sprinkle them all over his body.
Yeah. How'd that turn out?
They were too expensive.
Yeah.
Oh, not surprised.
They wouldn't line up all in the same
the thought that counts. It's the nano thought that counts.
You can make graphene with just pencil and some elbow grease.
Yeah, not nanotubes. You could make it.
No, you can make
graphene. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's close, right? And it's cheap.
Yeah, that's true. That's how they first made it.
Mm-hmm.
But all
you need
this
tape
reminds
too.
Me.
Tape. Sorry.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, tape would do it. Tape and lead pencil would do it. So. You know, like recently I was writing about the quote-unquote invention of the light bulb, you know, mm-hmm. and it really wasn't one big breakthrough, you know what I mean? That it was right. It was this incremental advance over decades with multiple people contributing. But at some point, it just all the pieces were there and it eked over that line to a commercializable product. And he gets the credit for, quote unquote, inventing it. But that's not really true. It was a much more complicated story. So we're seeing the same thing, just in a much more complicated way with all of this technology that we're talking about. It's just, you know, the point is, it's been this way for hundreds of years. This is not a new phenomenon, this sort of building up these, you know, solving one tiny problem at a time and then building it up until you get something that works, right? That's cost effective and is practical and can be manufactured and scaled and all those things that you need to do. But it's happening. You know, all these problems are being solved one by one, and no one study is going to be like the big breakthrough. It's just contributing to the overall progress. And the good thing is, we talked about this too before, is that it's not like we're waiting for something to happen. This is, in the aggregate, we are seeing incremental improvements in battery technology and solar technology and electronics every year, right? Every year you get another 1% or whatever of efficiency out of your batteries. You know, when we started the show, solar panels were like at 12% efficiency. Now we're at 20%. Remember that? We were talking about, 12%. But now we're at 20%. Like, the future's here. It just takes time. Just takes time. You know, in 10 years.
It takes time.
I mean, it's going to be really good after we've been dead for 50 years. It's going to be amazing.
I know.
Yep.
All right. Let's get away from all this technology and material science, Kara.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're going to talk to us about some neuroscience having to do with the perception of time.
Yeah, I mean, really, I think I want to dive a little bit into neuroscience meets psychology, meets philosophy, meets, you know, all of the different components that are really fundamental to this idea of time perception. There's a little bit of new research. I'm not sure how strong that new research is. We can, you know, dabble in that. But I would love to talk about and get you guys' input on sort of the combination of factors that contribute to how we perceive time. I know all of us know Sean Carroll. We love Sean Carroll. He's written books about the physics of time. Yeah, and about the arrow of time and quantum mechanics. But one of the things that's so relevant to people who are experiencing the weirdness of COVID-19 is that almost everybody I've spoken to has some personal, subjective complaint that time is moving weirdly to them. Have you guys all experienced that?
When you say weirdly, like freakishly slow?
For some people it's slow, for some people it's fast. It does seem to be different depending on the circumstances. I find that time feels slower, but then in retrospect, I'm like, where, like, things that happened last year feel like they were 5 years ago, but also I'm like, that was March, that was just yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's definitely, everything has been slowed down. Like, I feel like the calendar days are going by very slowly. But I've also noticed that I feel kind of like, like things are frenetic. Like, during the day, I just feel like, you know, I'm like friven every day because I've got a million things going on at the same time. And it wasn't this way a year ago. Like, I think it's just the overall stress levels go up and your perception warps because of it. You know, they're directly connected.
Well, it's interesting. So usually it seems like time flies by, right? At least in the last decade of my life. But this year seems slower, doesn't it?
Interesting. Yeah. And so you mentioned stress levels. You mentioned having a lot of different kind of pulls of your attention. Some of those things are really relevant here. And there are a multitude of factors when you look at the literature that do seem to contribute to our perception of time. We know, generally speaking, from a neuroscientific perspective, how time, well, I shouldn't say that, we don't know generally speaking, but we know from a neuroscientific perspective, sort of where in the brain time perception tends to be affected by change. And that's because time perception is inextricably linked from memory. So we often talk about the hippocampus when it comes to memory. We maybe haven't mentioned it much on the show, but there's the entorhinal cortex, which is in the medial temporal lobe. And that's sort of like the hub between the hippocampus and the neocortex. So, you know, your perception of time in a way that you can talk about it, like a way that you can conceptualize it and then verbalize it, that is more cortical, more neocortical. Hippocampal memory is, you know, it's a deeper brain structure. And in the entorhinal cortex, the interesting thing, this hub that's in the medial temporal lobe, not only has to do with time perception, but also in many ways has to do with space perception. And those things are also heavily linked. They're very near to one another. There have been really interesting studies that show that, for example, our sensory perception all has different time standards. So just like when you're in a storm and you're trying to figure out how far away the lightning is or how far away the storm clouds are, you know that there's a difference between how long it takes for the visual perception of the lightning and then the sound, the thunder, to reach you, and you can measure the difference. To some extent, in physiological psychology, we know a little bit of that too. Touch perception is different than visual perception. It's different than smell perception. And all of these things have different time cues connected to them. The interesting thing about time as a whole and our perception of time as a whole is that it's a synthesis of not just sensory input, but memory. It's a synthesis of where you are in the lifespan. That's incredibly important. And it's a synthesis of what's going on right now. So not only are we talking about the encoding of memories, but we're also talking about the experience of those memories. And I think one thing that literature hasn't done a great job, and especially the popular science write-ups of the literature, is talking about the difference between time perception as it exists, like in the moment, and time perception is a function of recall of memories, because those are two very different things. So we talked on the live stream recently about a friend of mine and I who were unlucky enough to have sort of a front row seat to observe a horrific accident, where not accident, but crash, where an SUV hit a man on a bicycle who wasn't wearing a helmet, and it felt like time slowed down. Steve mentioned that there are studies that show that time doesn't slow down. Obviously, it just feels like time slows down.
To clarify, Kara, the study was that your perception in the moment of time is not altered, even though your memory might
be. So you think that time slowed down, but your perception of what happened wasn't any different. But the interesting thing to note is that this comports really well with trauma studies that show something very similar. And that's that when you have sort of a flashbulb experience, a highly emotional experience, whether it's observing something traumatic, experiencing personally something traumatic, all the way from, you know, war to genocide to violence and abuse, those memories become ingrained in a way that's very in the moment, and they become, you have more timestamps available to you. That's one way that a lot of neuroscientists and psychologists like to put it.
Yeah, like
so
the
moment-to-moment encoding is so intensive that you're remembering a much richer experience because your attention is so acutely focused. Exactly. Think of it that way. And in one way, a good kind of extreme example would be, let's say you are watching a lecture, or you're watching a documentary or something that's like fascinating to you. You're very likely encoding memories more frequently as you're doing that because you're interested, you're excited, it's drawing your attention, you can't look away. And when you're watching a lecture or a documentary that's like, oh, so boring, and you hate it, you're not writing down those memories as nearly as frequent an interval. And so later, you don't remember it as well. But also in the moment, it feels like it's dragging on and on and on. So that's one other kind of explanation of how we perceive time. Now, the new study that was written up in a Nat Geo article recently, and I don't even think it's that new. I think it's more that they're talking about unpublished research from researchers that have been publishing over the time, because I couldn't find the full text of this specific article. These researchers from a Norwegian university have been studying time for quite some time and how we perceive time. And again, this is a multidisciplinary kind of thing. They're in a neurophysics, I think, lab, Kavli Institute for Systems Neuroscience. Neuroscience lab that has a lot of different components. But again, this field has been studied by philosophers, by neuroscientists, by psychologists for a really long time. They talk about, this is a kind of interesting thing, and there's a lot of people who actually are like, yeah, no. So I'm interested to hear you guys's, I don't know, more your subjective takes on this, I guess I could say, but that we know that wealthy people live longer. There also seems to be some evidence that wealthy people experience their lives as having been longer as well. And when they say, why is that? Why do, when you compare rich people who are old, why do they tend to say that they've lived longer? Like they have a longer, more maybe fulfilling life experience. I guess we can call it a hypothesis still. I don't think it's ready to be a theory, is that novelty helps you have a longer experience of time in retrospect, right? When you're drawing on those memories. So if you're experiencing rich and varied changes in your life, if you're going to interesting places, if you're meeting a lot of different people, you are going to have a longer perception of your life. And their argument is that rich people are in a position to be able to do that more. The counter argument, of course, is that many rich people don't have varied experiences. A lot of rich people have more control over their schedules and their lives, and so they actually choose not to engage. Some high-level executives actually are so entrenched in the work that they very rarely have rich and varied experiences outside of their jobs. And also, you don't need money to have rich and varied experiences. It does help if you're not stuck in a monotonous job that takes up all of your time.
I was going to say that, yeah, it might be more that your day-to-day is monotonous. It's not that you don't have the resources to do something interesting, so you don't have the time.
And that's why I think sometimes it's really hard with these kinds of claims, because it's like, what is the sort of mitigating factor here? Is it really have anything to do with wealth, or is it because of all these different intervening factors that lead to this, that lead to that, that lead to that? And I think this might be an example of that.
Someone just yesterday on the radio, Kara and Jay, expressed time in the sense of the number of meals remaining left in their life. They estimated they had about 20,000 meals left to eat in their life. And I thought that was a real interesting way of thinking about it.
Right. And those markers, you're right, Evan, are so subjective. And that's the thing. We want to talk about a one-size-fits-all perception of time. But I just don't think that as human beings, our lives are in many ways similar enough to say that. I think there are some through lines, neurological through lines, even psychological through lines that are sort of similar in all people. But we've all known people who measure time by when do they get to eat their next meal. And then we've got people who are the opposite of that, who forget to eat when they're engaged in other activities.
Oh,
and
yeah,
all of a sudden it's nighttime and it's like, oh crap, all I've had today is coffee. Yeah, I'm not speaking from experience. Yes, I am. So, you know, and when you have a severe traumatic event, when you lose a loved one, when you're really engaged in work that you love versus sitting through orientation like I had to do the past couple of days, your perception of time shifts in really significant ways.
All right. So, Bob, first we started talking about technology, and then we started talking about the brain. And now you're going to talk about the effects of technology on the brain.
Yeah, that's definitely part of this news item. This is a paper about a project that was recently published called The Third Thumb, which studied the impact on the brain of using an extra prosthetic thumb. This paper is published on the BioArchive preprint server. It's called The Neurocognitive Consequences of Hand Augmentation. Cool title. The project is led by Danny Clode, C-L-O-D-E. I could not find a pronunciation. Clody? Clode? I'm going to go with Clode, I think.
Clode sounds good.
Clode.
Yeah, right? A researcher. she is a researcher at University College London's Plasticity Lab. So, yes, an extra prosthetic thumb.
It's also weird that they call it the third thumb. I get it, because we have two thumbs,
right?
So it is your third, but on one hand, it's only the second thumb, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't have three thumbs on a single hand.
Yeah, but to say your second thumb wouldn't sound very interesting. Or to say, it would have to be your second thumb on your one hand. But yeah, it's all about pithiness. So
let's call it the extra thumb.
Yes, that's not bad.
The thumbelina.
So yeah, this intrigued me mainly because having an extra robot finger or arm or leg is just cool. It lets you have a robot part and still have all your other bits intact, which is kind of cool. Typically, right, when you think of a cyborg or something, you're thinking, oh, you know, you're replacing parts. Well, this is kind of not replacing, but adding, which is the whole idea behind this. I mean, look at Doc Ock from Spider-Man, right? I mean, I certainly don't necessarily want anything permanently fused into my spine. You notice how I said necessarily. You know, so I don't want that, but I'm thinking more along the lines of, say, Spider-Man's, like, nanosuit in Endgame, right? Remember when those spider-like legs that saves him from being explosively
awesome.
Decompressed into space?
Kara
or
remembers.
How about Invader Zim? Remember that show? Now, he had a robotic, like, backpack that sprouts these long, skinny legs that would lift him off the ground and walk him really fast and efficiently, which I thought was always a cool little thing. Or, I got one more example. Who saw that the alien kid on the new Rick and Morty spinoff series, Solar Opposites? So he had a weaponized version of that backpack. When he was in a threatening situation, like in a bar, he's in a barroom brawl. His backpack came alive, basically, and these robotic appendages appeared out of nowhere from the backpack to autonomously slice and dice everyone within 50 feet of him. He's walking around casually, apologizing, while these robotic appendages are flying out, wasting everybody around him. It was the most unforgettable scene that I've seen in animation. It was awesome.
Bob. I'm so glad you love Invader Zim.
Oh, my God.
Gurr is like one of my favorite cartoon characters of all time.
I want Gurr so bad. Gurr is just the most adorable thing around. So, okay, so we're not going to see anything like that or even Gurr very soon. But perhaps this new idea is the Model A of that technology. All right, prosthetic thumbs. How do they actually work? What are we talking about? Because there's so many different ways to have a prosthetic robotic thumb. So the thumb is 3D printed. Its complexity is it's low on the complexity scale. The thumb straps to your palm, so it's on the opposite side of your biological thumb, right? So if you have your right hand facing your face and you put your left hand behind it so that just the thumb is sticking out, that's what it kind of looks like. It's got your two thumbs on the opposite side of your palm. So that's what it looks like. The thumb has 2 degrees of freedom. The thumb can cross the palm. That's called flexion and extension. And it could also point straight up at the side, like your other fingers. That's called adduction and abduction. So now the thumb. That thumb connects to a bracelet around your wrist that has servos and wires. So that's the big unit of this thumb. The other piece of it is connected via Bluetooth to sensors on your shoes. So when you press down your little toe, for example, the robo thumb moves. So when I first read that, I'm like, wait, you're involving feet. You just totally lost me on the coolness of this whole thing. And it does sound awkward. But if you think about it, I listened to Clodie give a talk. She made a lot of sense. Now, our major limbs, they naturally work well together, right? Think about it. We already team them up to extend what the hands are doing. If you're a drummer, if you're a good drummer, you're using your feet. If you're a pianist, you're using that pianist thing and pedal on the ground, on the floor, right? What a weird name. So
Bob, you know what that's called?
What? The pump.
That's called the fact that you can coordinate.
Oh no,
your different limbs. It's synkinesis.
That makes sense.
And that's why it's really hard to draw the number 6 and move your foot which way in a clockwise.
Oh God!
Way
now
at the
I have
same
to
time.
Do this. Damn.
It's really hard to do. You have to some people can, but you have to train yourself.
You have to inhibit synkinesis. That. Mm-hmm. And that's a test that we do. You know, like, for example, we'll have somebody do something with only their right hand. And if they have like frontal lobe damage, they'll do it with both hands. Right. And it'll be hard for them to not do it with the other hand.
So now Claude had the best example, though. She compares it to steering a car while simultaneously using the gas pedal and brake. Now, we do this, right? So that's something we do unconsciously every day. Well, before the pandemic, we did anyway. But you're not thinking about, I press the gas pedal down and I turn. No, you think about moving forward and then your foot automatically just presses the pedal. You're not even thinking about it. So, yeah, they can work in concert very, very well.
Or, Bob, if you're a gamer, you know, you're using the mouse, you're using the WASD keys, you're doing all kinds of things and you're not thinking about what you're doing.
Right.
You're thinking about, I want to move my character over there. You're not thinking about what you're pressing.
Yeah, and it's like part of the plasticity of the brain where it'll adapt to do these things. And regardless of everything that we just said, these study participants were able to quickly learn how to use their third thumb. They ramped up very quickly. So it was not hard, as awkward as it may sound to, you know, press your toe down in order to flex your new thumb. Sounds weird, but it really wasn't. So for the study itself, they had 36 study participants. They gave them extensive training and work sessions every day, and they were also encouraged to use the prosthetic thumb as much as possible, at least 4 hours a day outside of the study itself in their daily lives. Apparently, they achieved a lot of firsts in this study. Claude describes it as the first ever technological augmentation fMRI study. In the paper that they wrote up, they claim that it's the first comprehensive demonstration of successful motor integration of a robotic augmentation device. Kind of a different way to say it's a very similar thing.
Wait.
Yeah.
Wait. They haven't done robotic prosthesis studies with an MRI before?
Not an fMRI. Apparently not.
That sounds,
I don't know,
wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
Uh-huh.
I'd
have to look that up.
Look it
sometimes up. I find that a lot, by the way, just as a generic thing, that when I'm reading a news item, that they make claims about being the first that aren't really true. That's a very
frequent
thing.
Like the first
thing.
Within these narrow parameters.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. There's some kind of
first time on a Saturday this was ever tried.
Yeah, often they're very narrow parameters. And this is what she said at her TEDx talk. Could have been, you know, a year old. I'm not sure. I didn't look at the date. But that's what she said.
All right, Bob, here's one. Brain-machine interface via real-time fMRI, preliminary study on thought-controlled robotic arm, 2008. But I think, I suspect that there are some other caveats in there.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like there's probably a couple other ones. So their major goal of the study seems to be to see the impact of this augmentation on the way the brain represents hands internally, or as they called it, the sensory motor hand representation in the brain. So they wanted to see what happens to that mapping. So in her TEDx talk, she showed some fMRI scans. And of course, I'm no expert, but her claim was that they showed some level of integration of how the toes are mapped along with the hands. Because she said that the hands and feet are generally mapped to different areas of the brain. But after this study, some of the study participants seemed to have some integration of like toe mapping and hand mapping. So the researchers say in their study that they showed that the participants experienced an increased sense of embodiment over the thumb, meaning that it started to feel more like a natural part of the body, which is like, right, that would be a goal. That would be a critical primary goal for any type of augmentation like this. Another challenge that they were cognizant of and studied was the potential negative impact of integrating something like a new appendage onto a pre-existing brain body representation. You know, what happens when the thumb is removed? You know, you use this thumb for a few weeks, you use it, you remove the thumb, what happens? You know, obviously you don't want there to be a cost to the user's biological body representation, right? That would be bad. You don't want a downside like that. So reading the paper's conclusion, they really kind of they pulled it all together in this quote. They say, as technology becomes more integrated with the human body, we see new challenges and opportunities emerging from neural and cognitive perspectives. Critical questions arise as to how much human-machine integration can be best achieved, given expected neurocognitive bottlenecks of brain plasticity. So here we demonstrate that successful integration of motor augmentation can be achieved with potential for flexible use, reduced cognitive reliance, and increased sense of embodiment. Importantly, so here's where they bring in the negatives. Importantly, though, such successful human robotic integration may have consequences on some aspects of body representation and motor control, which need to be considered and explored together. So, yeah, because they did see that there is this potential to interfere with this brain body mapping that could have consequences, and they definitely would want to look into this in the future. So, I mean, that was this. So that's pretty much a decent overview of their paper. And it's just interesting to think of what kind of things we would want to do or would be interested in doing if we could create like a really good extra finger or arm or even leg or
tail.
Right. Or there you go. Or a prehensile tail or hopefully eventually some sort of backpack with killer appendages at your disposal would be fun, too.
Yeah. So again, this is very incremental, to be honest with you.
Sure.
And we've been talking about this for years as well. And this is in line with all of the prior research, which is basically showing that brain plasticity doesn't really have any practical limits when it comes to incorporating robotic prostheses, either integrating sensory information or, you know, rewiring the motor cortex to control it. It's never going to feel like your dominant arm. I think a good way to think about it is, but it could get to the point where it feels like your non-dominant arm. It feels like it's part of you. It feels like you have control over it. The control is pretty good, but you're not going to be playing the violin with it.
Right. You know? It's still like slightly awkward.
Yeah, it's still going to be, it's not going to feel quite 100%, but definitely usable.
Right.
And this is, this study, again, this fits, you know, again, just video game experience. I don't, and I'm not really worried about having it on sometimes and not on other times. Oh, but I think it's like a minor nuisance at most. I find that my fingers go to the WASD keys even when I'm not playing the game. You know what I mean? Like, that's like they just go there. Wow. That's their resting place.
It'd also be interesting, although unethical, to see the difference. And I think we already know what would happen is that if you did this with a child and then they developed with this third thumb, that it might actually become very fluid and feel like they're dominant.
A very young brain.
We're
going to
be doing that in the future. Mm-hmm. There's no question.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that, because they when you know, when they do a, if you have a prosthetic arm, and if you say you lost your arm but like below the elbow, you know, they have prosthetics now that integrate with the with your muscles, the muscles that previously used flexed your fingers and moved your hand, right? So those muscles, they have a muscle memory because they did it for years and decades. So adapting to the prosthetic is relatively easy. But if you had somebody that was born with no arm below the elbow, they never had that muscle memory, and for them, it's a much more difficult process to work with the prosthetic. They've got to train the muscle to know what to do, and they just can't, you know, dive in as nearly as quickly as somebody who already.
Well, but
they can get there, right?
Yeah.
And also, if they're learning to walk with a prosthetic, it might not be that different than learning to walk without a prosthetic.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that from like monkey studies where, let's say, an additional finger was added to a hand or two fingers were tied together from a very young age. You're just going to develop the neural architecture to support that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
Now, what would it be like to have some sort of appendage that you've mapped to, that, you know, feels like you're off arm, say, but also have some level of like autonomous control to help with the finesse, right? To make it more, you know, like a dominant arm.
True.
That's an interesting idea, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I bet you would get used to that too. Like, for example, if you had AI embedded in your prosthetic,
you would think you were doing it, right? Your brain would say, yeah,
and
I'm
then,
doing
yeah,
this.
You're,
I'm
you
doing
are
this.
Controlling it.
Oh my
yeah,
gosh.
But it's stabilizing it and giving you more precision or whatever. That's, yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, your brain would fool itself totally. This is all me.
Crazy.
All right, Evan, it's time for the Ig Nobels. Give us a whirlwind tour of the Ig Nobels 2020.
Okay, yeah. For those of you who don't know, the Ig Nobel Prizes honor achievements that make people laugh, then think. That is their catchphrase. The prizes are intended to celebrate the unusual, honor the imaginative, and spur people's interest in science, medicine, and technology, generally speaking, along with a few other fields thrown in there. Every September, they have a ceremony at Harvard University at the Sanders Theater. We've been to at least one of those. I know I've been to at least one of those. I think we all went as a group one year.
We did.
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of fun. A lot of laughs. It's a good time. You know, it's fun when the humorous meets the scientifics. And this is definitely one of those occasions. This was the 30th time they've done it. 30th anniversary. So it's called the 30th. First annual Ig Nobel Prize ceremony. Every year it's the first annual. It's just a different, you know, number in front of it. So it happened last week, and here were the categories and the winners. Category in acoustics, awarded to a team of scientists for inducing a female Chinese alligator to bellow in an airtight chamber filled with helium-enriched air.
Aww.
Oh, I know. It's a poor alligator.
Oh, it probably sounded so funny.
And yeah, you can read about this in the Journal of Experimental Biology. That sure is experimental. And what did they find out? Well, when you put an alligator into an airtight helium-filled chamber, you find that the high energy frequency bands of their bellows got even, what? Higher,
yeah, obviously.
The results are the first evidence that non-avian reptiles produce sound from vibrations in the vocal tract known as formants, F-O-R-M-A-N-T-S. No alligators were harmed in the study, but a noted side effect was that 40% of researchers at least one time uttered during the study, "See you later, alligator." In economics, it was awarded to a team that studied the relationship between different countries' national income inequality and the average amount of mouth-to-mouth kissing.
Mm-hmm. Why do they think there would be a relationship?
Right, yeah, that's a good question. And having read it, I still don't quite know. And one hopes this was a pre-COVID study. I think it actually was. But basically what they're saying is their outcome was that relative poverty, which, you know, income equality, predicts frequency of kissing across romantic relationships.
If you're poor, you kiss more? Is that what they're saying?
Yes.
No, if you're relative to the GDP of your country, right?
Right.
They're talking about
relatively
income inequality.
Relatively speaking. Yep. Clearly more research is needed in this field. Lots more.
No, it's not.
All right, moving on. Entomology. I like this one. Awarded to an American researcher who collected evidence that many entomologists are afraid of spiders, which are not insects. In the test, they sat subjects down on muffins and they had to eat whey and curds. So from childhood, right? Now, the survey of these entomologists explored why people who devoted their careers to critters such as cockroaches and maggots still found spiders unnerving. And apparently among the most disliked traits of spiders were that they were fast and had unpredictable movements, and not to mention the many, many legs. Material science, Bob, awarded to a group of scientists for showing that knives manufactured from frozen human feces do not work very well.
Oh, I remember that study.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that one got a lot of media attention. Of course.
So supposedly, I had not heard this before. There's an account of an Inuit man manufacturing a knife from his own frozen feces to butcher and disarticulate a dog. And apparently this is somewhere in popular culture. I don't know. Have you guys ever heard of that?
I have heard of it. I don't know if it's true, though, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the impetus for the study.
Desperate survival technique. So they were testing whether the story...
So they put on their...
Yeah, it was like a Mythbusters episode.
They did. They put on their Mythbusters hat to test it out. And no. It was not functional, no matter how many times and how many ways they tried to do it, and who knows what kind of details that entailed, right?
Yeah.
So it gives the phrase cutting through the shit new meaning.
Cut the shit.
In medical education, it was awarded to a group of world leaders, including President Donald Trump, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, President Vladimir Putin, President Yair...
Putin, and
President Bolsonaro. And they awarded it to them for using the COVID-19 viral pandemic to teach the world that politicians can have a more immediate effect on life and death than scientists and doctors can. So, now, actually, that was more of a, just a point, not a real study, but, trying to drive the point home, which they did. Medicine award awarded to doctors for diagnosing a long unrecognized medical condition, misophonia. MISOPHONIA, which is the distress at hearing other people make chewing sounds.
Yeah.
It's not
that
though.
Is a
That's
thing.
Only one aspect of misophonia. I don't know why the chewing sound thing takes the cake, but misophonia is just
face noises, breathing noises, among other things.
I think
things.
It's just a severe reaction to certain noises.
But they seem to...
Yeah, hatred of sound. The word means hatred of sound. So it's reactions that trigger like a sympathetic response. But it can be oral sounds. It can be clicking, nails on a chalkboard. All of that is considered misophonia.
Interesting.
But yeah, for some reason, people often talk about chewing noises as if that's what the word means.
Do you have misophonia if you don't like the sound of nails on a chalkboard? Or is that just being human?
Well, yeah, a lot of people don't like that, but it doesn't make me feel like I'm going to vomit. But the other two, literally, I have a strong sympathetic reaction to. I feel ill when I hear them, and I have to get out of that place.
Weird.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, two more I'll touch on real quick before we go. In physics, it was awarded to a team that discovered what happens to the shape of a living earthworm when one vibrates the earthworm at high frequency.
Oh my God.
You want to know if it became a sphere?
Yeah, exactly.
Does it get shorter or longer? What does happen?
I cracked up too much to really figure out what the heck they were talking about here.
Like, it's like a vibrating shape.
But, just where do they find this stuff? And lastly, in psychology, awarded to a pair of scientists for devising a method to identify narcissists by examining their eyebrows. They showed people photos of faces with different areas concealed, and the researchers found eyebrows were an especially important nonverbal cue for gauging narcissistic personality traits.
Okay. I'd like to see the effect size of that study.
Yeah.
Yeah,
totally.
That study sure had a lot of pluck.
Oh, yeah. You wrote all of those, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Yes, you did.
All right. Thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
Always fun.
Yeah, it's good to have a laugh.
The real nobles are coming up soon, right?
Yes, they are. October.
Really, always seems like they come around so fast. Right? My perception of time.
Every year.
The Nobel Prize. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Last week I played This Noisy. Yeah, that's a long one. So what do you guys think that is?
A harmonica?
Well, Steve, you are not alone in guessing that. Let's just dive right in, shall we?
Mm. Yes.
So I had somebody write in, Richard Smith wrote in and said, this week's noisy sounds like a harmonica stuck on a vacuum cleaner. that was so like funny. That. And he sent a video of it. And it is a very funny thing to see. So I suggest you look that up. It's not a harmonica, and it's not a vacuum cleaner. Brian Personnel, P-R-S-O-N-A-L. That's probably not his real last name, huh? No, it isn't.
Or a typo.
I don't believe. This man's name is Brian. Hi, Brian. He says, Jay, is it the John Cage piece As Slow As Possible? Have you guys heard about this?
Mm-mm.
Let me tell you about it. It's an organ piece, and it lasts for like 600 to 700 years or something, and it just changed chord for the first time in a few years. So yeah, this is real. The slow as possible. And I'm not sure how it's being played back, but it is supposed to take 600 to 700 years to finish playing. So yeah, it's just basically like, imagine they slow something down so much that it just, you know, is on the same chord for a decade or whatever. I don't know. So it's, you know, an art piece, I guess, but... That's not it. And many people wrote that one in, and the harmonica, by the way. That was a hugely guessed thing. I think the number one guess we had. Another listener named Lee Hunt said, hi, Jay, I'm not sure about this one, but it kind of sounds a bit like a shang or an ancient Chinese woodwind instrument. And Lee, that is not correct, but here is a shang so the audience knows what they sound like. Of course, there's other instruments in there, but that was a shang, and that wasn't it, but that's a really cool instrument. You should look it up. And sadly, no winner. No winner this week.
Whoa. Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was absolutely sure someone was going to be able to guess this one.
Absolutely.
So the original sound was sent in by a listener named Zoe, so thank you, Zoe. So here is what it is. This noisy is from a video, and it's from something called the Solar Drone Art Installation in Studio Bell, the National Music Center in Calgary, Alberta. So it's an art piece. It was constructed out of pianos that were destroyed in the previous music center during the 2013 flood, which caused massive damage throughout southern Alberta. Since the installation is powered by solar panels on the roof of the building, they only can make this sound on a sunny day. But since Calgary is one of the sunniest cities in Canada, it's pretty often. So I did look up a little bit more information. So it was a Colorado artist named Patrick Merrill who unveiled his sound sculpture titled Solar Drones. It's a public piece of art. In 2013, he put out an international call for RFQ submissions. And this thing came in. A solar drone, as Merrill explains, is a combination of solar panels, electromagnetic currents, and piano wire. Powered by the energy from the sun, the musical vessel creates consistent musical notes that are not always obvious unless you know what to listen for. The weather-dependent vessel will not always be present in the bridge because the pianos are installed on this walkway bridge. And once a cloud rolls over, the piano wires stop vibrating. So that's pretty cool. I just think it's a very interesting thing. And so if you look at it, it's multiple piano bodies that have been refurbished and then installed into the ceiling along this bridge. And then there's certain, you know, chords that he has selected. Very cool. I have a new noisy for this week. I will switch over to it. New noisy sent in by a listener named Jake Bathman. Bathman. His last name is
Bathman.
Jake Bathman.
Bathman.
No, Bathman.
Here is the noisy. Thank you. You hear that end part?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My clue for you is the end part is important, and I don't think I should give you any other clues, but I will tell you that this thing, I will give this little clue, this thing is not a dot matrix printer.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking that.
Yeah, some people would, though, I can tell. I have a noisy sense. So you could email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org with any suggestions you have for noisies, and you can send your guesses in there as well. Now, Steve, you started off today's show by saying that, you know, we hit a milestone number in COVID deaths, 200,000. Mm-hmm. But there is a bright side to hitting milestones in the world, and one of them is that the SGU has hit, we have now achieved more than 4,000 patrons.
Whoa.
Yay.
All right.
Wow.
Yeah, so people responded to our requests over the last couple of weeks. We really appreciate it. Of course, we appreciate everyone who supports the SGU. But thanks to everyone who joined over the last couple of weeks, pushing us over 4,000. Actually, right now as we record the show, we're at 4,041.
Wow.
So that means that the 12-hour show is on, kids.
We are.
Yeah, so to be fully transparent here.
Kara, just your perception of time is off, that's all.
So that's true. I just need to be really interested.
Take 3 hours, it feel like, tops.
Steve, to be fully clear and transparent here, it might take a month to stabilize over 4,000 because at the beginning of every month when our patrons get charged for their membership, you know, a certain percentage drop off for various reasons, of course, you know, going through COVID. So I'm suspecting it might take at least another month or two to consistently be above 4,000, but we hit the mark and we know that, you know, we're here now. So I'm sure that we're going to be okay. It is still also a great time to show your support to the SGU because we can actually really, really use it right now for the reasons that we've said in few episodes before. So please do support us if you can. You can go to patreon.com/skepticsguide. But guys, what does this mean? It means that we are going to have probably two things happen. Steve and I are talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
We could do a 12-hour live stream from the studio whenever we want and during COVID. It could be soon. You know what I mean? We could plan it and we have to write it. We could do the 12-hour, but then we could do a special SGU event at the Star Trek Museum that doesn't have to be coupled with the 12-hour thing because it could potentially be a massive delay.
It could be a year from now.
Yeah, it could be a full year from now, which would be ridiculous. So I'm thinking about it, when he first said it, I'm like, no, because we said
we're married to that idea.
Yeah, but then I really thought about it, turned it over, and I'm like, all right, you know, you guys deserve, you know, our patrons deserve that 12-hour show. They asked for it. We should do the 12-hour show. I really want our patrons to help us shape the content so they have a huge hand in what the 12-hour show is. So, you know, not right now, but we'll set up, you know, an email address or something or a web page or some way for you guys to be intrinsically involved in that 12-hour show. And of course, we're all going to be thinking about, like, you know, what does that actually mean? It could just be ideas on what we can do. It could be, you know, all sorts of contributions that are given, whatever. We'll work it out with you guys. But
yay! Keep It'll that be like view. The best Friday live stream we've done. It'll be like a really extended version.
Yeah,
that'll be awesome. Oh my gosh.
We'll do lots of cool stuff, but we're going to have to, I mean, we're thinking of sometime over the winter, right? We think like January, Jay, because we want time to book people. You have everybody along enough heads up that they could clear the day.
Oh, right. So we can get
guests. So we can write content.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not just going to chat for 12 hours. We're going to have stuff happen. It'll be
although we could, you guys. You have no idea how long it takes us to record this episode weekly.
I know we can, but I don't think that is what we should do. I think we should build some content in there, so which we have done for our previous marathons, our 10-hour and our 24-hour.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of the conversation I had with Steve is that this doesn't mean, by no means does this mean that having an event at the Star Trek Museum is not going to happen.
Good.
Steve knew that wasn't even on the table. We still want to do it. The problem with that event is that who the hell knows? Just like, you know, Nexus, like a in-person Nexus thing, it's so impossible to plan an in-person thing unless we actually can rely on dates. So the only thing that I'm going to do is this. I'm going to work out all the details with James Cawley, who's the guy that runs and owns, and the, you know, it's his vision and everything. This guy is the mastermind behind the whole thing. I'm going to work out all the details, and then he and I will just say, when you know the world starts to look like we can do it, we will engage in this agreement that we came up with. And so it doesn't have to be 12 hours of us pumping out content. It could be like an all-day event where it's maybe more like 8 hours instead of 12. There's a big difference between 8 and 12 hours. And then we could do
We could optimize it for the venue, and we're not locked to 12 hours. So I think decoupling the two events is good in many ways.
Yes.
All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have an interesting theme this week. I don't think I've ever done this before. The theme is follow-ups to previous news items.
Okay.
Crap.
So these are things that we talked about. Yeah, maybe. These are things we've talked about in the past, and I just looked up some follow-ups to see like what's new with this news item, or I came across them. And so, but of course, one of these is fake. Okay, are you guys ready?
Yes.
All right, here we go. Item number one. Researchers have demonstrated the cause of the Australian fairy circles, a reaction diffusion pattern of water dynamics following a mathematical pattern first proposed by Alan Turing. Item number two, a new analysis finds that the amount of life necessary in the clouds of Venus to produce the phosphine signature is several orders of magnitude less than the biomass in Earth's clouds, making life a more plausible answer. And item number three, scientists have identified the first confirmed murder hornet nest in Washington state. Bob, go first.
Australian fairy circles. Yeah, I believe everything that has to do with Alan Turing, so I'll say that's science. Let's go to three. First confirmed murder hornet nest in Washington state. Wow. Across Washington state. Okay, I can buy that. I mean, that's kind of the part of the country, I think, where they were initially seen. So yeah, I could buy that. So what you're saying is that so to reproduce the phosphine signature in Venus that we're seeing would take orders of magnitude, hundreds to thousands of times less biomass than in Earth's clouds. I mean, we got tons of bacteria floating around out there in the atmosphere. I can kind of make sense of that. That makes sense too. Shit, so what am I gonna pick? All right, screw what I said. I'll say phosphine's fiction, whatever.
Jay, go next.
All right, the first one here. Researchers have demonstrated the cause of Australian fairy circles. So, Steve, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Are you expecting me to know what Australian fairy circles are?
The circle patterns in the grass that are a mystery as to what's causing them? Until now.
Okay. All right, there's like these weird circle patterns, and they're saying there's some type of thing in physics that's making them happen, and you're saying that this is possibly true. Okay, the next one. A new analysis finds that the amount of life necessary. So if I'm reading this correctly, you're saying that it wouldn't take that much life in the clouds of Venus to produce that much gas, right?
Correct.
That's interesting. Let me just move on. The next one. Scientists have identified the first confirmed murder hornet nest in Washington state. So Steve, how would they know that they have nest zero? You know, like how do they know that that is the first nest?
Well, okay, but it's the first confirmed one. It's the first one they found the first one that they found.
It's the first one.
It's not necessarily the first one that's been established.
Oh, okay. Well, that seems totally plausible.
It's just the first one to be found.
Yes, that's okay. That one is science. I can agree with that. That seems very obvious that could be legitimate. And we're just talking about Washington State, meaning that they got that far north, I guess. I mean, how in the hell? I'm not even sure that the other two like have anything that I could actually vet and figure out. It's more of just a total gut reaction. One of these is fake. I'm going to just say the one about Venus is fake because I just don't think we know we don't know enough, and anybody trying to figure this shit out is wrong.
Okay, Kara.
I think I have to part from the guys. Mm-hmm. Because the first two, the fairy circles and the Venus, just require analytic investigation. which I think both did. The third requires like a hard documentation. Like there has to be an observation of a nest. The other ones are like, oh, we're just comparing the numbers. And so really, A, anybody could publish something like that. And B, it could also be like people could argue against it. Whereas you can't really argue against, look, we found a murder hornet nest. Here it is. Here's the evidence. And I've been following murder hornets. And all I can say is I haven't come across the fact that there's a nest. We just keep finding individual hornets. But if we found a nest, that would be really scary. And I think it might make the news more. I could be wrong. I probably am wrong. But I hate going out on a limb. It's so scary. But I'm going to say the murder hornet nest is the fiction.
Okay, and Evan.
Oh, you're not alone, Kara. I'm going to join you in the murder nest one, so you'll be okay. You're not alone.
Okay.
Even if
we can
go
lose
down,
together.
Even if we go down to stinging defeat here. Yeah. The Australian Fairy Circle one. Water Dynamics, I'm not surprised with that one, I think, because at least, you know, regionally here, it has to do with mushrooms and other fungus and things going in the ground, which also have to do with water, directly or indirectly. And the Venus stuff, yeah, I think that one's right. So the Murder Hornet one, for all the same reasons, Kara, that one's the fiction.
Okay, so you all agree on the first one, so we'll start there. Researchers have demonstrated the cause of Australian fairy circles, a reaction diffusion pattern of water dynamics following a mathematical pattern first proposed by Alan Turing. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Alan Turing.
Oh, Alan.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So... it's interesting. So Alan Turing obviously was a mathematician. He's most famous for the Turing test for not distinguishing artificial intelligence from a person.
And so much more. Please look him up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. He came up with this mathematical equation that describes how things interact with each other, and that's how patterns can spontaneously emerge. And it turns out that predicts the fairy circles. And this was confirmed now in the Journal of Ecology by ecologists who found out that in certain situations, if you have just enough like aridity, like an arid or semi-arid environment where water is limited, the grass actually tries to hold on to the water. And the way that it does that causes it to interact. Again, the diffusion of the water, et cetera, causes it to interact according to this mathematical principle that Alan Turing figured out, and they could perfectly explain the patterns that are seen in the Australian fairy circles in the grass with this mathematical equation. So whatever that was 60 years ago, 70 years ago, Turing, what's interesting is that how widely this mathematical principle applies in nature. Like this is not something that he specifically was thinking about when he came up with this, with the mathematical formulas, but it appears to apply.
Yeah,
so
there's just
cool.
There's a handful of historical greats that really are like the gifts that keep on giving.
Right.
Yeah.
Like Einstein, like that just like decades and even centuries later, they keep confirming things. It's so cool.
Pattern forming interactions between grass and water. That's what's doing it. Okay. Bob and Jay, you think that Venus is fiction. Kara and Evan, you think that the murder hornets are fiction. So we'll just take these in order because it doesn't matter. Number two, a new analysis finds that the amount of life necessary in the clouds of Venus to produce the phosphine signature is several orders of magnitude less than the biomass in Earth's clouds, making life a more plausible answer. Bob and Jay, you think this one is the fiction. And this one is... science. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
Evan.
Hey, Kara.
Woo!
Nice.
So this is good news, I guess.
This is cool.
Follow up on our Venus thing. So this is just like a back of the envelope order of magnitude calculations. Like, okay, how many bacteria, how much biomass would we need floating in Venus's clouds in order to be producing the amount of phosphine that would account for the 20 parts per billion that we're detecting in the clouds? We talked about this last week. And because if it was huge, if the amount was too high, that would make life not a plausible answer, right?
Right.
If, for example, it had to have 10 times or 100 times the biomass as Earth's clouds do, that that would seem to make it less plausible. But they found out that it wouldn't require much, in orders of magnitude less than the amount of than the living things that we have floating around in our own clouds. So that is, again, this is all inferential, but it at least removes one potential objection, to the possibility that that phosphine signature we're seeing in Venus's clouds are coming from living critters. So I thought that was cool.
Yeah, very cool.
We're heading to Venus. All,
yeah. Oh, absolutely. This, you know, the, definitely this has to be a high priority for NASA now. All right. This means that scientists have identified the first confirmed murder hornet nest in Washington State is the fiction carrier.
It was in Oregon. Oh, no.
You're exactly correct. They've found a couple of more bodies or semi-living hornets. These are the giant Asian hornets.
Yeah, do we know how many we've had so
murder
far?
Murder hornets. Like six or seven.
Gotcha.
Sightings. I think six or seven sightings and I think only two actual specimens.
Oh, wow.
But they found a queen, a non-mated queen, and they found a male drone. But they're setting up traps, and the hope is that they'll be able to capture a bee alive and then follow it back to its nest.
Mm. So they do think that there are established colonies that we just haven't been able to find. They don't think these are like weird flukes where they're coming over in, I don't know, ocean.
They don't know.
Cargo.
They don't know. It could be. Gotcha. It could be isolated. It could be isolated individuals. You know, so-called invasives coming over, rather, but because it would take, you would have to have a mated queen in order to form a nest, and so but that's the question, because obviously, if there's one nest out there somewhere, right, then that creates the possibility that these, you know, the murder hornets. There's another study, actually, the study that I based this off of, that if there is an established nest in Washington State. They said, like, what environments are compatible with them? They could spread all up and down the Western seaboard, you know, it could spread far and wide. So that they're would be a horrible invasive species because they're called murder hornets because they decapitate honeybees. Mm-hmm. They'll go in and they'll wipe out an entire nest. And, you know, our pollinators are having enough of a problem as it is without murder hornets, you know, murdering them. So this is why they want to find, if there is any established nests out there, they want to find them and destroy them quickly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's one of those things where you got to nip this in the bud, because once they get out, it's going to be hard to eradicate them. So they don't want to wait, you know, until until somebody finds a nest. They want to go out looking for the nest.
Right.
If they trap any of these hornets, they'll track them back. If they lead back to a nest, they'll take out the nest. But they don't know that there's a nest. They're hoping there isn't. But if there is, they want to find it and take it out.
Ugh. By removing the head or destroying the brain.
Yeah, they're big guys.
They're
a big
so
stinger.
Gross.
And people who have been stung describe it as searing pain.
Yes,
searing.
They say it's... It probably won't kill you. It has killed a few people in
sure,
the past. Like,
yeah.
It probably won't kill you, but you'll wish you were dead.
Oh, all right. Well, good job, Kara and Evan.
Thank you,
yay,
Steve.
Evan.
Yeah, well done, Kara.
That was a fun one, though, right? Doing the follow-up?
Yeah, not at all.
It was hard.
Bob and Jay, maybe.
I also, as like Jay, literally have no memory of talking about fairy circles.
I thought it was a joke.
Yeah, no memory.
Okay, Evan, give us a quote.
An informed appraisal of life absolutely requires a full understanding of life's arena, the universe. By deepening our understanding of the true nature of physical reality, we profoundly reconfigure our sense of ourselves and our experience of the universe. Brian Greene.
Oh, Brian.
We love Brian Greene.
Very nice.
And for those who say, why is it important to understand the nature of quasars and pulsars or the, you know, gravitational wave?
Who says that?
I yeah, right? Cool. I want to meet them, set them straight. Yeah. You have to understand that all of this matters. It really does.
No, absolutely. No, all of science works together. It's all describing the same reality. You can't really peel off any part of it.
Yeah,
it makes sense unto itself. You know what I mean?
Think of it as a giant puzzle. We're just filling in more and more pieces. That's never
totally.
Ending. But the more we fill in, the better we understand everything.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks,
guys. Steve. See you on Friday.
Yeah, we'll see most of you. I know Kara's out this week, but we'll see most of you on the Friday live stream. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions. dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.